Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, November the 6th. In his book, Innovation Nation, How America is Losing Its Innovation Edge, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do to Get It Back, John Keogh writes, I see a crisis coming and it makes me angry. We should be doing better than we are. We have the talent, money, track record, and infrastructure necessary for continued success, but we are rapidly becoming the fat, complacent Detroit of nations. We will wonder why this is happening and what our guest thinks should be done about it. And we will wonder if you agree or not, or what ideas you have. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What is at stake, according to our guest, is the future prosperity and security of our nation. John Keogh is a leading expert on innovation, large-scale transformation, and high technology. He taught at the Harvard Business School for 14 years, is the founder of Keogh & Company, an advisory and venture development firm that counts leading companies, government agencies, and political figures among its clients. He also serves on the Department of Defense Transformation Advisory Group, where other members include Senator Hillary Clinton and former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. He is the author of the book Innovation Nation, How America is Losing Its Innovation Edge, Why It Matters, and How We Can Get It Back. Good morning.
Joy, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks.
So, how is America losing its innovation edge?
Well, you read some of the feistiest words from the beginning of the book, so I have to catch up to the energy level you've created here. I think that, first of all, we have to be clear about what innovation is for a country. Many people talk about it in general terms, and of course, it's one of the most widely used words in the English language. Last year, I gave a speech at Google, and I Googled the word innovation and came up with about 330 million hits. So I think that we have to understand that innovation is what allows a country to progress. It is not just harnessing science and technology, but also harnessing the creativity of the entire diverse citizenry in the interest of exploring what's next, exploring where the country wants to go, how it fulfills its purpose. And so an innovation capability isn't just about creating some new stuff or being a little more prosperous. It's really about, in my view, the fulfillment of national destiny. We look back a little bit at history. You know, America has always historically been the innovation nation. We've been a country of explorers and inventors and tinkerers. We have harnessed our inventiveness to the ideal of being a force for good. And after World War II, we were basically the only act in town. You know, everyone wanted to come to America to study at our universities. They wanted to become new Americans and share in the American dream. And so we basically did not have a lot of competition in the innovation game. But if we fast forward to 2007, there are two things that are going on in the world that I think are worthy of note. One, which is, I think, inevitable, is that many, many countries around the world, whether you talk about little well-run countries like Finland and Singapore, or big countries like China and India, for that matter, are getting a lot better at the innovation game. The second thing that's going on is, I believe, and this is why I wrote the book, out of this sense of upset, as you referenced, my feeling that America is taking its foot off the gas pedal, that if you look at the sources of innovation, which have to do with how a country produces talent in its education system, how it attracts talent to its shores, how it funds new discovery, how it establishes the right kind of climate for thinking about what's next, we're falling down in all of those areas.
Yeah, and why is that? Because we don't want to pay for it, or what?
Well, I think at the heart of it, it goes to ethos. You know, we're a country now that spends more on astrology than astronomy. And there was a recent stunning statistic I stumbled across, which said that more graduate degrees are now given in parks and recreation than in foreign languages and cultures. So the ethos question is really about values, about what we think is important. I do like to say once in a while that we resemble the third generation wealthy in this country. We had a great generation that discovered the wellsprings of prosperity. We had a second generation that built it. And now, in a sense, we seem more intent on consumption than on reinvention and looking ahead to what the horizons might be for the 21st century.
Yeah, give us some examples of or some evidence of us losing this innovation edge. How do we see this happening?
Well, I think that, first of all, talent more than ever before votes with its feet. So these days, on a global basis, talent is mobile in a way that it never has been before. So, first of all, we in this country have relied historically on waves of smart immigrants who have not only come here for graduate school but have decided to stay here. And the ranks of our Silicon Valley founder teams, you know, people who start new high-tech companies, the ranks of people who teach science and math and engineering in our universities are disproportionately populated by people who were born abroad. The fact of the matter is that someone who's talented and born abroad is more likely to return to their country if they come to the United States than they were before. Some of that's based on rational self-interest. You know, it used to be probably that the delta between living in the U.S. and living in Bangalore or Shanghai was stark and enormous. But now, the quality of life in those countries has increased dramatically. There's also the question about America's public image in the world and the sense that many people who might have immigrated here would rather go home. Now, the other part of the talent piece, and this is only one component of the larger innovation landscape, is that there's beginning to be some evidence of flow of talent out of the United States. Some of this is based on the programs that other countries have developed, such as, for instance, the government of Singapore in life sciences, to target leading U.S. scientists and attract them to Singapore. You know, if you're a life scientist, you can go to Singapore, you can get paid more money, you can set up your own lab, you're not subject to stem cell restrictions, you have abundant resources for doing animal experimentation if that's what your research requires. All the impediments to doing high-quality scientific work are taken away. And so recent years have seen a flow of everyone from the former head of the National Cancer Institute to the former dean of the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine, relocating to Singapore. And, you know, it's also the young. You know, the meme at business schools these days is, you know, if you don't have a central casting kind of job, go to Shanghai, go to Beijing. Those are kind of the new opportunity centers. I was in Shanghai in June, and it seemed like half of my former students were there whooping it up because it felt very much like an opportunity-rich environment. Yeah. So this is one of the symptoms, I think.
Yeah. Well, other symptoms?
Other symptoms. Well, let's make the assumption, which I think is an easy one to make, that our production of talent through our education system is important for our ability to be innovative as a country. Well, let's look at how we're doing in international comparative rankings in mathematics, for instance. Mm-hmm. We're not number 1 or number 5 or number 10 or number 20. We're actually number 24th on a worldwide basis. And this is in an education system where we spend more per student than just about any other education system in the world. Yet we're not getting the bang for our buck, so to speak. Our schools, in the kind of bleakest examples, have turned into what a researcher at Johns Hopkins recently termed dropout factories. You know, he says that there are 10% of American schools have dropout rates approaching 40%. And in San Francisco, where I live, about a third of high school-age kids did not graduate from high school. Now, I don't know what these kids think they're going to do. I don't know what kind of careers they have in mind, if they're even thinking about that, but there are limited numbers of jobs, and perhaps fewer than in the past because of outsourcing, that lead to some kind of a career. And so the notion that our education system, our public education system, is falling down in terms of creating, making talent, as I refer to it in the book, is an issue. But it also goes to the high end of education as well. You know, we still have the majority of the great universities in this country compared to, on a worldwide basis, we have 38 of the top 50 globally ranked universities. But if you look at a country like Finland, small country, less than 6 million people, they have twice as many PhDs per capita as the U.S. because they've made a conscious decision that investing in highly skilled people is a national priority. And the absolute number of engineers and PhD scientists in China, for instance, not only crossed the American rate of production a while back, but is accelerating at a dramatic rate, whereas ours, you know, has been maintaining or in some respects, like the physical sciences, declining as a share of doctorates awarded for, steadily over the last few decades.
We are talking with John Kao. He is author of Innovation Nation, How America is Losing Its Innovation Edge, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do to Get It Back. We wonder what you think. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. Ben will be talking about current issues of the day after 4 o'clock and after 5. Is a new 21st century media emerging with opportunities for progressives to shift the conversation about national values? Well, yes, according to Ben's guest after 5 o'clock. We are talking with John Kao. He's a former professor of business at Harvard, currently a consultant and author of Innovation Nation, Why America is Losing Its Innovation Edge, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do to Get It Back. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We'll talk more about what can be done to get this back. But since our lines are full with callers who want to ask questions or make comments, let's take a few calls. Rich in Rhinelander is first. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was in Denmark only briefly teaching, but I heard again and again from the Danes, we're a small nation, we have to do it this way. And I was there as an exchange teacher for Wisconsin's adult technical college system. And my students in Denmark were paid to go to school if they were unemployed. They were required to study, in addition to English, at least one other foreign language. They considered Italian and Spanish to be the easy languages, Japanese and versions of Chinese to be the more challenging languages. And again, I was reminded that there's something sinister going on, at least I thought it was sinister, in that American entrepreneurs are chasing lower paid, extremely high-skilled labor overseas, even while they are complaining about the costs of education at both the university and the college level in our own nation. I consider it extremely unpatriotic for American business people to be undercutting the educational system in our country, even as they recognize that they can get extremely talented people, and I mean extremely talented people elsewhere. Final comment is, compared to China and India, the United States of America, like Denmark, is indeed a small nation.
Yeah, well, what do you think of that, Mr. Kao?
Well, I think that it's one of these and also kind of situations. I think that there's little doubt that America as a country needs to think through the issues of how to be more attractive to talent and also how to be more attractive to, for instance, the whole range of American companies that now are behaving like international companies, not really like American companies anymore. I think that we also need to look at this issue of creating homegrown talent. I think that we're in danger in this country of becoming two Americas, you know, one of which is well-educated with a lot of occupational mobility, with a lot of choices, with a reasonable amount of prosperity, and then a second, much larger America that was relatively poorly educated, increasingly poorly educated, I would argue, with fewer options and with a real disparity between what they desire for themselves and what they're able to achieve in terms of what the economy has to offer. So I don't disagree with the idea that American businesses need to engage with resources at home. But I also think that this business of globalization is inevitable. I think that entrepreneurs are going to go wherever the opportunities are. And, you know, if there are software developers in Russia or in Singapore or in China who can complement the resources they have available here, it's going to be in their self-interest to scan the globe and to put together the resources they need to make things happen. We can't stop that. I mean, globalization is a fact. We can't put up walls of protectionism in a digital era, but what we can do is to pay attention to getting our own house in order.
Thanks, Rich, for the call. Robert in Crystal Lake. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the structural factors here in the United States which are preventing innovation. First of all, first thing that comes to mind is that Ronald Reagan cut the NIH funding severely during his presidency, and he encouraged private industry to conduct more of the research.
Oh, okay, hold on. Is that one of the causes of this, John Cale?
Yes, it is. Basically, if you don't fund basic research, which are the wellsprings of long-term innovation, if you focus your funding on more tactical near-term agendas, then you're going to sort of cut off the opportunity stream. And if other countries are investing more in basic science, they're going to be the ones that are going to capture the value of these big new streams of opportunity. So I think federal funding of research, well, it's not just the government, it's private sector as well. I think generally speaking, we've become a much more short-term, more practical, results-oriented community in terms of how we fund research. And it's a shame because America actually spends about half of all the R&D dollars or, you know, all of the R&D money worldwide. But the way we're spending it is not giving us the best return for innovation.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Robert.
Yes, there's also a subtle point between NIH funding and private industry funding, is that any research that's conducted at the NIH is in the public domain. It's completely open source, whereas anything that's done in the private sector is an industrial secret. And companies will sit on their products for, you know, sometimes decades until the marketplace will give them the greatest return on their investment.
Well, and I think that especially when we look at the kind of opportunities that are on the horizons for us, whether it's nanomolecular materials or personal medicine or personalized medicine or new approaches to genomics, these are not little opportunities that a few venture capitalists can fund a few companies to address, or even that one company can address. So the whole idea that in the 21st century we need to reinvent some of the models for research so that, you know, it's neither about federal policy alone nor about, in the case of life sciences, big pharmaceutical companies or venture capital firms or NGOs, but a coming together of interest groups to kind of develop a strategy for addressing these opportunity streams, it's really going to push us in the direction that we need to go.
Yeah, you want to talk some about federal funding for stem cell research and whether that's a problem in your in your view?
Stem cell research is obviously controversial at a kind of ethical and values level. But I think that there's a fair amount of agreement on a worldwide basis that stem cell research has the potential for generating a whole host of life-saving and life-improving treatments. So the question then becomes, where is that work going to be done? Now, there are places in the world that are actively pursuing stem cell research with no restrictions. We have a lot of restrictions. You know, there are Chinese walls that get built in between the part of a lab, for instance, that's funded to do stem cell research and the part of a lab that isn't, so that if you want to use a pencil for stem cell-related activities from the non-stem cell-related inventory of tools you have, you can't do it. You're breaking the law. And so I think that there's been a kind of a dampening of the energy level in terms of stem cell research just because of the amount of regulation and oversight and kind of public controversy that surrounds it. So what we're going to see almost inevitably is that people who are looking for stem cell treatments for their various medical needs, including Americans, they're going to go abroad. They're going to go to Singapore. They're going to go to China. They're going to go to India and Europe to get the kind of treatments that either they can't get here or which, you know, are not as well developed because the effort to develop them has been hampered.
Next, we go to Steve. And, Steve, I don't know if you're listening in Houston, Texas, or if that's where you're from.
Yeah, I'm listening online. Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you think you've already answered, you've already stated the answer to, I think, the problem. And I think, you know, we have great teachers in our schools, and I used to live in Wisconsin, and we had great teachers. But I think the substance of our education is the core curriculum in our math and sciences is collapsing. My two sons both had the opportunity to go study in South Korea for 1 and 2 years. And what I discovered was quite shocking. They were taking, in 7th and 8th grade, they were taking very kind of complicated, very intensive algebra courses and taking science courses. And then they came back to the States where they're in school now, and they found that they were taking, in 1 or 2 years later, my eldest son is now a junior, and he's basically 4 years later studying the subjects that he was studying 4 years ago in South Korea. And my wife, who's from Japan, has told me that this is a similar situation there. South Korea, after the Korean War, basically adopted our educational standards and the standards that we had at that time. And we've since then replaced them. We watered down our curriculum. You know, now our test scores in America are saying that our kids are doing great. But if you look at the level, the standard that they're being tested at, it has gone down and down and down. So, you know, you have kids that are saying, you know, they're graduating with all these abilities, but compared to where they were even 5 years ago, you know, it's, I don't know how to, qualitatively, it's not the same. And I think that unless we, and this is where Wisconsin Public Radio comes in, because, you know, you have a tie with the university system, unless somebody speaks a little bit of tough love to our schools of education, and unless we start teaching, instructing, the math and science teachers in our schools to really get tough with kids, to have dress codes, to have high, to challenge kids who are gifted in math and science, and quit coddling a lot of bad behavior in our schools. Unless we change fundamentally the paradigm of the way our schools are run, and bring back, you know, really hardcore curriculum in math and sciences, I think, you know, America doesn't have a prayer, quite frankly. I told my kids out of public schools down in Texas.
Yeah, listen, you gave us a lot to chew on here. Thank you very much, Steve. Is that what is needed, John Kao?
Well, look, there's no doubt that in the 21st century, America needs to take a hard look at its education system. If we're spending more per capita on students than any other place in the world and not getting the results, we need to reevaluate. And simply doing incremental improvement, like more homework or more textbooks or even more teachers, is not going to address the heart of the question of what does education need to be in the 21st century. You know, how does a education system with students who get more digital experience outside of the classroom than inside deal with digital natives? What should the classroom itself feel like? How can teachers be motivated to stay in the teaching profession? How should teachers be compensated? Should there be incentive compensation? What should curriculum look like? And this is why we need innovation in our country as a skill set, not just as a slogan. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who say, oh, we need an energy president in 08, or we need an education president in 08. And I've been saying for some time that we need an innovation president in 08, because only someone who is able to pull together all of the interest groups and knock heads and put them in a room and get them to sort out questions like, you know, what is the education system for America for the 21st century? Are we going to get some meaningful answers? And that will require a lot of innovation. If we do stuff the same old way, and that's why the Detroit metaphor comes in, you know, successful companies doing things the way they've always done them doesn't necessarily lead to being able to reinvent yourself for the 21st century, and that's what we need to be able to do.
Yeah, all right. Well, besides the innovation president in 08, what else is a part of your fix?
Well, I think the fix starts with the need for us as a country to acknowledge that we have a problem. It's very easy to be complacent about these issues because there are no obvious pain points. In 1957, when Sputnik went up, America was traumatized. And whether we were behind or not, Dwight Eisenhower led the country in the direction of a national innovation campaign that included reforms in science policy and education and the establishment of NASA and DARPA and many other initiatives. And here we are 50 years later, and I believe there's a real gap that's opening up, that's yawning wide, but there's complacency. So I think, number one, we have to understand that there's a problem. And secondly, we need wise stewardship at the national level, at the regional and local level, at the company level, at the community level, where people are able to articulate the challenge that faces America and to be able to oversee the process of creating a roadmap and a strategy for our country. I'm not advocating sort of a top-down, in gold-plated industrial policy effort, but I do think that the kind of initiatives and the kind of reforms and the kind of opportunities we're talking about require some planning. You know, when we were in World War II and Einstein said to Roosevelt, there's this thing called nuclear fission, we didn't put an RFP out to the private sector and say, let's have the answer bubble up with the invisible hand. I mean, the government took a firm hand on being the helping hand, the guiding hand, to make something large scale happen. And we need the same kind of Manhattan Project sized initiatives in clean tech and in life sciences and in education and many other fields. So what it's going to take is awareness of the problem, stewardship, creating a business plan for America that has innovation at its core. Then there are a lot of tough decisions that have to be made. I mean, one issue is, how are we going to fund the future in an era where we are spending money hand over fist for national priorities that have nothing to do with innovation? So, you know, the Congressional Office of Budget recently stated that the wars we're in are going to cost $2.4 trillion plus. And, you know, whether you believe in it or not, that's a lot of money. The American Society of Civil Engineers recently issued a report that said America's infrastructure, public infrastructure, you know, bridges and roads and dams and stuff like that, gets a D.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to cost $1.3 trillion to get it up to an adequate level. And then we're spending over $1 billion a day just on national debt service. If you think about what Singapore has spent to create a life sciences industry, it's several billion dollars, you know, $3-4 billion. Well, you know, that's about 3 days of national debt service. You know, we could create 100 biopolises, as the Singapore government calls them, a year in relation to what we spend just to service our national debt. So there's an issue about aligning national priorities with the need for large-scale innovation. And we're going to have to get innovative about the process of innovation. So the notion of creating a whole portfolio of regional hotspots that are themed around sunrise industries that build upon local capabilities, that involve new ways of creating investment capital that are public-private partnerships, invoking fiscal policy. You know, we're number 24 in the world for R&D tax credits that are a major policy tool for getting R&D labs to locate in specific areas. There are many other countries that are more generous than us, so it's no wonder that a lot of research labs get set up. In fact, the majority of the R&D lab decisions are looking at, decision makers are looking at China and India right now. Mm-hmm. So I think that we have to go from the general, we have a problem, we need stewardship, we need a strategy, to then consideration of the components of what needs to be done in terms of reigniting our innovation engine system by system. That's the going to be the harder work.
We have more callers who want to talk with you. Need to take a short break. Before that, though, John Kao, is there a candidate running for president that you think would make a great innovation president, or aren't you endorsing these days?
Well, I'm not really I didn't write the book for political reasons per se. I think there are a number of interesting candidates out there, and I think that several of them have been talking about innovation as a national agenda. And my goal in writing the book was really to get the national conversation going about this issue. It's hard to talk about unless you have some basic definitions and conceptual tools. But once you have them and start connecting the dots between the education issue and the research issue and the funding issue and start looking at all of these different challenges we have, things begin to fall into place. And then I believe my fellow citizens for whom I wrote this book will be able to make better decisions about who they want in the White House, in the Senate, in their local government, etc.
We're talking with John Kao. He is author of the book Innovation Nation, How America is Losing Its Innovation Edge, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do to Get It Back. John Kao, a leading expert on innovation, large-scale transformation, and high technology, taught at the Harvard Business School for many years and is founder of Kao and Company, an advisory and venture development firm. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him about innovation in America and how to revive it. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock, talking with his guest about the House and Senate expected to override a presidential veto. The president's veto of a $23 billion water projects bill. Find out more about that coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking about Innovation Nation, the book by our guest, John Kao, and our next caller is Roger in Shorewood. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Terrific show today. I have several patents and things, and I received them 15 years ago, but with five patents, it was really amazing how there was absolutely no support or excitement in the marketplace for novel innovation. I mean, things that don't change the world, but they'd make a good business, you'd have your protection, and with such little support from the government, I had one idea that I wanted to propose on a federal and state level, and that is if you actually spend all the money to get patents, that the federal government, and you have to actually get it, but they actually step in and they help offset those expenses, and you have to make promises, things as you will have it manufactured in the U.S., you'll hire primarily, you know, U.S. workers, certain segments of society, all these things where you'd have social benefits, you'd be innovative. But the major problem, I think, of all the symptoms you've identified, I still think remains our manufacturing base, which is why there's not really going to be a fix in the future. We miss the boat on stem cells, and other countries are doing it. As you mentioned, their societies are more sophisticated, and so the people who are coming here and staying here as doctors and certain professionals now go back to their own country to hopefully do some very good work that they've never had before. So you lose this manufacturing base, which was why everybody came up with new ideas for cars and appliances and all these things. And with what goes on in the Far East, everybody stealing intellectual properties and other things, other properties that hold value, they become good at manufacturing, and they do it cheaper. And I think our problem is our manufacturing base, and I don't think there's going to be a fix anymore.
No,
I think manufacturing is gone, and I'm wondering what his thoughts are on this.
Yeah, me too.
Well, so there are a couple, you raised several points. One, I think, about manufacturing is it's hard to compete at the commodity, low-cost end of manufacturing, and we've seen those businesses essentially leave the United States. I think that the country that offers the best model for America going forward, or at least for some inspiration going forward, is Denmark and perhaps other Scandinavian countries, which have been able to dominate extremely high-end, high-tolerance, high-precision manufacturing. I mean, Denmark has the world's majority market share in precision pumps and windmills for the energy industry and so on. And that's where innovation and high manufacturing standards come together to create comparative advantage. We have companies in solar panels and other areas, biotechnology manufacturing, that are deliberately locating themselves in the U.S. because they want to have access to innovation and they're at the high end. So I think there's also a whole social policy question around how workers get retrained, what kind of manufacturing capabilities we want in this country, and the answer is not clear. I mean, I agree with you that we've essentially gotten out of manufacturing, we've gotten into services. The structural issues around how employable our workforce is going forward are very knotty questions. The other thing that you mentioned was patents, and I think that The government actually does a reasonable job of funding small businesses that have innovative ideas, but the problem always is about how the entrepreneur connects the dots. And, you know, digital technology and digital market spaces that link up inventors and entrepreneurs and brokers and investors and so on offer some remedy there. But overall, I think the patent process needs to be reevaluated in the sense that, you know, anybody who's applied for one knows that it's expensive, it's laborious, and it's often quite slow.
Thank you very much, Roger. Noah in Eau Claire is with us now. Hi, Noah.
Hello. I was calling. First of all, I just wanted to say thank you for bringing these issues to the forefront, because these really are the issues we need as Americans to have at the forefront of our minds when we go and vote. And, you know, so many things go into this economic downturn, and clearly I think you would agree that the size of government plays a major role, as well as foreign policy. And but, you know, the only candidate that I think is really including all of these factors and offering solutions is Congressman Ron Paul. And I was wondering if you support any of these ideas that he has, such as cutting the Federal Reserve out completely. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, I'm not going to, I think, endorse any specific candidate. I do think that innovation for government, you know, how to make government more innovative and leaner and smarter, is a perennial issue that faces all countries, perhaps ours in particular. You know, again, I think that government does, however, have a role to play in the innovation process at a national level. You know, government prints the money and oversees the policies around education and is a source of demand for the fruits of R&D and national security and many other fields, establishes fiscal policies that support research. I mean, so government is about creating the game board, and we could argue that better government creates a better game board, leaner government creates a better game board, but we're going to need government. Government is not going to go away. What we do need, however, is a new kind of understanding, a new compact, if you will, between federal, state, local, and private sector to get innovation galvanized community by community.
Thanks, Noah. Now, Amos in Sauk County. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. I agree that we could do a lot more with technology in our schools, but I think the bigger issue is, and which isn't being addressed at all in any of the comments that I've heard, and certainly in what you're saying, is that we need an education where we can look at technology critically and we can decide whether the technology furthers what our goals are as a society or whether we're simply a cog in a technological machine. And you talked about, like, for instance, Iraq is going to cost us $2.4 trillion. If we had had the historical knowledge to not invade Iraq, then we would be up $2.4 trillion. You talked about DARPA. I'm not convinced that funding DARPA, which is basically a military program designed to enslave people, is an intelligent thing to do. You talked about we need all this money for bridges and roads. I'm not convinced that building more bridges and roads is better than doing our infrastructure for mass transit. So to me, the real question is, what do you do with that technology? It isn't to be simply follow the Chinese and let us test animals in the labs and say this is ethically fine. It's how, what kind of a society do we want? And that's a very complex kind of education, and we're certainly not getting into our schools now, and I don't hear any advocation, you know, I don't hear you advocating for that type of education at all.
Mm-hmm. What about
well,
that?
You know, I mean, I think I've gotten out about 2% of my ideas, so I doubt that we'll be able to take the total grand tour, but I do agree that technology needs to be put in perspective, and I agree that social values and technology need to be balanced out. I think that innovation is about a lot more than high tech or science. It's also about how we innovate from a design perspective. It's about how we incorporate the arts. And it's also about how we incorporate a word that I use at the top of the show, the ethos, our set of values into what we want for ourselves as a country. So, you know, I think we're in sync. My definition of innovation is the capabilities for realizing your desired future. And, you know, America has always had a very promising, bright future. We've always looked forward to the horizon. It's only now that we're beginning to say, hey, what horizon or where do we want to go? Those are very, very important questions. And I think the social value of science, you know, all of these questions, you know, presumably these are the kind of questions that are debated in learned circles in government and think tanks and academia and so forth and so on. But I don't disagree with the idea that we should also be decentralizing them down to what kids are learning about. That's very important.
Yeah, thanks, Amos. George in Madison is with us now. Hi, George.
Hi there. Kind of a segue to the last gentleman. I see this innovation as one of many effects, not causes. The cause is that we don't have a government that represents us anymore, neither party. And until we have that, we won't solve immigration, we won't solve education, we won't solve health care, and we won't solve innovation. This is one of 1,000 points of darkness that we need to re-enlighten by changing the way our government is working and the way it represents us. So this, to me, is way down the line. Thank you.
So we can't fix the innovation problem unless we fix government, John Kao?
Well, I think fixing government is a large and somewhat amorphous topic. Mm-hmm. I said about 10 or 15 minutes ago that I think that absent stewardship, and what I mean mm-hmm. by that is leadership. We need leaders who can address the issues that face our country, and with regard to innovation, frame innovation as being the kind of challenge that will engage the energies of Americans. You know, we have a story that we've been living in terms of in America, which is our spirit of exploration and discovery and our appetite for risk and so forth and so on. And those are values deeply woven into our cultural DNA as a country, and that I think are there to be reignited by the right kind of refreshed national narrative, if you will. So I guess God is in the details in terms of what kind of transformation of government one has in mind. I mean, I'd settle for somebody in the White House who deeply understands this issue, speaks about it in a sophisticated way, and most importantly, puts a process in place for addressing it. I mean, I agree that, you know, absent leadership and absent, you know, a sense of national purpose, you might have innovation, you might not. But I think that, to me, innovation is such a big story, it kind of underlies a lot of the other challenges that we have.
Yeah, remember when President Bush said, let's go to Mars, and that fell with a big fat thud, and everybody said, what's wrong with him? And I mean, what happened there?
Well, look, in the 60s, Kennedy said, we're going to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And it was a perfectly timed initiative. You know, it was post-Sputnik, it was... You know, we were still in the glow of our technological prowess, and the moon was kind of the high frontier, it was the new frontier. So that's an example of an authentic challenge, well-framed, which mm-hmm. galvanized the country. And, you know, boy, that walk on the moon was very hard to do, and it's not even clear how well we would do that today. But if we fast forward 50 years, you know, I think we've learned from the Mars example that simply throwing out a mm-hmm. challenge without a deep understanding of what's going to resonate with the American people and what is, in a sense, relevant at this moment in history, is going to lead to something of that nature falling flat, that it's just going to be a gimmick. It's not going to be an authentic challenge.
Yeah. Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hello. I think that one of the assumptions you're making, that you've said this many times, that we spend less on education than you know, most other nations, most other advanced nations, if not all others.
We spent more per capita.
No, we spend more on education, rather.
Yeah. Right.
The problem is, I think that's a misleading figure, because if you examine what we spend on education compared to as a percentage of our GDP, it's actually lower than most other advanced nations. So, I mean, yes, we spend more in terms of absolute dollars, but we spend less in terms of percent of GDP. And the other thing is, I think part of the reason we've lost our edge in innovation is that there's just simply not any money in it. We have a huge brain drain of people going into fields like law.
Or hedge funds.
Yeah, or hedge funds. Mm-hmm. And people who create wealth out of basically nothing. People who... You know, the joke has always been among lawyers, you know, we're going to become a country where half the country is suing the other half all the time. And, you know, I think that we also have a bunch of, in government, it's very ideologically bound. You know, there's this mantra of the free market is God. And, you know.
Right, right. And, you know, we're I just want to, Bill Gates makes a little bit of dough, though, John Cale.
Well, I don't have any problem with people making money by the fruits of their talent or intelligence or their ability to be entrepreneurs or take risks.
Yeah, Bill was saying that the reason why we don't have innovation is there's no money in it.
Well, I think there is money everywhere for innovators if they are able not just to come up with the rock star idea, but also figure out how to get it developed and get it commercialized. So, I mean, I actually think that if you look at, for instance, the Fortune magazine list of the most innovative companies, for instance, compare them with the S&P 500, those companies outperform in terms of market cap and in terms of return on equity. And there's plenty of evidence to suggest that, you know, innovative breakthrough ideas yield a lot of financial benefits. I mean, eBay wasn't a particularly technologically sophisticated idea. It was a brilliant business idea and a marketing idea. I'd love to have some of their stock from when they first went public.
Mm-hmm. One more, Jeff in Winneconne. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, we need to move forward a little bit better in the computer science area to try to create new jobs for everyone in that area. Our manufacturing is gone. There's people making a dollar an hour overseas, and that's the reason why we don't have any jobs. During 1920s and 1930s, it was very easy to get a job. You could get out of high school and get a job right away without any education at all. Nowadays, you need a exuberant amount of education, and we just don't have that here. What we need to do is get these companies back into the United States, charge them extra amount of money for taxes so that they cannot set up over there and make these people work for a dollar an hour.
We have really just a little bit more than a minute, John Cale, for a reaction to that.
Well, as I said earlier, I think that especially in a digital age, it's going to be impossible to put up walls around the U.S. And I think overall the globalization of innovation and the fact that other countries are good at it, other countries are good at manufacturing, ought to put us on notice that we've got to raise the level of our game as well. So it's one thing to protect ourselves, and it's another thing to try to innovate to do things better. So, you know, that's really why I wrote this book. I wrote this book to start a national conversation and also to get people to understand that Innovation Nation really starts with each one of us, with what we do to educate our kids and work in our companies and work in our communities and elect our public officials, and that we all have a responsibility. You know, it's not just the person sitting in Washington or the person sitting in the state capitol or that CEO or that head of a federal agency that we can point the finger at. We ought to look in the mirror and point at ourselves and say, what have we done today to try to contribute to America as the innovation nation?
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
John Cale is author of Innovation Nation, How America is Losing Its Innovation Edge, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do to Get It Back. John Cale, expert on innovation, large-scale transformation, and high technology, a former professor with the Harvard Business School. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, and thanks to Brittany Dialda for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.